Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
Last year, the Commerce Department rolled out a new financial management system meant to improve the department's financial management. However, things have not quite gone as planned. Implementation issues have resulted in National Weather Service employees not getting reimbursed and electric companies shutting off power to equipment used by NOAA. Bloomberg government reporter Jack Fitzpatrick broke the story late last week and spoke further with Federal News Network's Eric White.
The Department of Commerce was instituting and still is in the process of instituting a new financial system that their payments go through. They started at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which includes the National Weather Service, which a lot of people are familiar with. And they put it in place last October. We still don't know the full extent of how bad this was, but long story short, it did not let payments go through. It didn't actually let the money go out of the system for invoices or travel reimbursements to their own employees in thousands of cases, totaling at least tens of millions of dollars, according to an inspector general report. And that caused some significant issues. They weren't paying their electric bills in some places. I spoke to the manager of an airport in Georgia who unexpectedly lost access to a NOAA system that provides weather information to pilots. It was fortunate that weather wasn't very bad that day. Otherwise, flights might have been redirected. There's an instance where NOAA weather radio went down in Alabama because they lost power to their radio transmitter in Cullman, Alabama. There was a meteorologist who travels to the site of natural disasters who for more than 5 months could not have traveled because he had maxed out his government travel card and wasn't getting the money to actually pay that off. So some significant issues essentially based on NOAA not being able to pay its bills for a number of months.
Does the agency know, you know, what the root cause is, or was it just simple, you know, growing pains of bringing in a new system?
If they know for sure, they have not said publicly. The inspector general report on this said that on the invoice side, there was a data mismatch between this new system at NOAA and the system that the Treasury Department uses. I have followed up with the inspector general's office to say, hey, can you explain what exactly the data mismatch was? They have directed me to the Department of Commerce. NOAA has not explained, and the employees affected have not gotten an explanation. So when you talk to a meteorologist or a local emergency management person who's affected by the issue, they still have not been told, hey, here's how this got messed up, and here's what we're doing to fix it.
Yeah, and I'm sure that those employees' union reps were frothing at the mouth as soon as they heard that employees were not being reimbursed for business expenses.
Yes, there actually was a grievance filed by the union that represents National Weather Service employees that mentioned 25 employees of the National Weather Service who were waiting for months for travel reimbursements, in many cases totaling thousands of dollars. The person I talked to was owed $5,400 for more than 5 months. And according to the union, it affected 25 people. And that's aside from issues with paying contractors, paying the electric bill, that kind of thing.
We're speaking with Jack Fitzpatrick from Bloomberg Government. And so I imagine with employees being directly affected by this problem, this wasn't a whistleblower case, so to speak, just because it would be so out in the open and so many people were affected. But it has kind of been kept under wraps. I mean, how did you yourself come across this story?
The first way I came across it was because of the National Weather Service Employees Union. There have been for years some issues with the National Weather Service being understaffed in areas. Congress has discussed that. I wanted to learn more about a variety of those issues. I coincidentally called the new president of the Employees Union for the National Weather Service not long after they filed the grievance. She mentioned that to me. And it was clear that this was a broader issue. It's the travel reimbursements not going out to employees, but also it blocked a lot of payments. So between that and then reaching out to a lot of local people who were affected because, you know, the NOAA weather radio went down in Alabama for a little while, that kind of thing, I have pieced together this story. But I do think there is probably a greater extent and a greater breadth than I have even learned. So I'm still working on learning exactly where and how these problems have happened, because it does seem to be quite widespread.
I know that you said the agency hasn't outlined exactly exactly what went wrong, but let's go back to implementing this new system overall. Was there a need to shore up? I imagine that purchasing can always get more efficient, especially when you're talking about big agencies. Is that what the case was? It was meant to streamline things and, you know, obviously make things easier, and it just hasn't gone to plan?
Yeah, it was meant to streamline things. This is replacing a system that had been in place at Commerce for a number of years, I think more than 20 years. And employees have said, look, there should be advantages, and it's likely that there still will be. But the issue was they didn't understand how difficult it would be. Evidently, there was a data mismatch that caused more problems than expected. And there were cases where the communication wasn't where it needed to be. I spoke to the chief meteorologist at the Huntsville, Alabama National Weather Service office, who, after their problems getting the money out the door, despite his efforts to pay the electric bill, said the lesson learned from his end is you have to communicate to vendors, to contractors, to everybody. We're going to have to work through some issues. Let's communicate ahead of time. And that is one of the shortcomings here, was that a lot of people were left in the dark, and then power was cut off in some cases without a heads up.
Yeah, when you're talking about major pieces of infrastructure and safety going down like that, I'm going to guess that members of Congress were probably piling on about the agency's problems as well.
It did get to Congress. I know that in one instance in Alabama, the radio transmitter that went down is right where Robert Adderholt is based. He's from the Cullman, Alabama area. Adderholt is a senior appropriator, a pretty influential member of the House. I heard from the locals there that they struggled to get traction until they reached out to Congressman Adderholt. And when he followed up, the bill was paid pretty quickly. There hasn't been a lot of finger pointing at Commerce. There haven't been a lot of demands for public answers about this, but at least in that case, I know that it got to a very senior member of the Appropriations Committee who followed up, and that's how that instance was taken care of.
Finally, you know, has the agency given any sort of timeline or any sort of expectation for when these employees will finally be reimbursed for traveling to these disaster zones?
Well, some have been. In fact, the meteorologist who's based in LA, who I talked to, Rich Thompson, first talked to me about his issues, and then shortly before we published the story, he got paid. So we were at least able to confirm that after a little more than 5 months, he did eventually get that $5,400. The agency, though, has not answered questions publicly on where exactly they are in the process of working through that backlog. It does seem that they're paying bills now. It's not that they're building up a greater backlog, but it's a messy experience trying to make those payments. And they have not said how much money they owe at this point, where they are in the process of how many bills still need to be paid. I haven't gotten answers on that, but they seem to still be working on it.
Jack Fitzpatrick, reporter for Bloomberg Government, speaking with Federal News Network's Eric White. We'll post this interview along with a link to Jack's story at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected. and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective, we get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency, And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions. And that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion. And then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there taking notes on the meeting and said, go ahead and I want to hear from you. And I realized in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way. And I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped. And I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture. And what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful? So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth, and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going, because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career. And that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, and work alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.